Vice President of the Vancouver Institute this year and your chairman for this evening. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, who is Mr. Harry Schwartz, a member of parliament in South Africa, a member of the Progressive Reform Party. He will speak on peaceful change in South Africa, the role of multinational corporations as instruments of change. Mr. Schwartz.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the paper which I intend to deliver tonight was in fact one of a series of four which I proposed to deliver as a result of my invitation to come to Vancouver, an invitation that was issued to me by the Del Grauer Foundation. And the papers in fact constituted four particular items. The first of these papers were to be to deal with the question of the possibilities for peaceful change in South Africa. The second
ladies and gentlemen, what we should establish is firstly whether there is a democratic right of anybody to put a point of view. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, the second point that we should establish is whether those who seek to prevent others from speaking are the fascists, or whether those who seek to put a point of view are fascists. I had indicated to you, ladies and gentlemen, that I was now delivering the fourth paper in a series in Vancouver, the first of which dealt with the possibilities for peaceful change in South Africa. The second dealt with apartheid and the development of apartheid in South Africa. And the third dealt with the relationship of South Africa with its neighbors. The fourth is the paper tonight, which deals with peaceful change in South Africa and the role of multinational corporations as an instrument of change. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that you are entitled to hear tonight what is proposed to be said as being a democratic right that you have to decide whether you want to hear. The Vancouver Institute, having been made aware of the fact that on previous occasions endeavors were being made to stop a hearing, has taken the steps of seeing to it that there is a copy of my address which can be delivered to each one of you here this evening, so that the voice of democracy can still be heard despite the very small minority that seeks to put an end to it. And they will now be handed out to every one of you, a copy of the notes for my address, so that this kind of action by a minority cannot prevent you from becoming aware of the facts as they are to be put to you. We will wait, ladies and gentlemen, until you all have a copy of my address, and then we'll continue.
Together, this one's giving feedback, so.
I think, ladies and gentlemen, you'll agree with me that even those who are making a noise should get a copy of the speech so that they should know what the facts are. And the ladies and gentlemen who are doing the distribution will even show the courtesy to those people in the corner and give them copies of the speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to say just one thing. I'm South African. There are people in South Africa who at this moment are in jail for holding views which are similar to Mr. Swartz's. He deserves a better reception than what he's getting from the people at the back of this hall.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think now you've got copies of what is going to be presented. You're able to see what is going to be said. So whatever the situation is, you're now going to know what the facts are and what is intended to be said. And the small minority which seeks to suppress the facts, the small minority which arrogates to itself the right to call people fascists, the small minority which holds the democratic majority to ransom, I think will be frustrated. And I want to thank the Vancouver Institute for the trouble they've taken to make sure that you will know what I wanted to say tonight. And I want to start off by thanking the Institute for this courtesy. I also want to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this address was intended to be one of a series of four, and it is the last of the series of four and deals with the subject of peaceful change in South Africa and the role of the multinational corporations as instruments of change. I also want to say to you that if you are given the opportunity, I am quite happy to answer any questions at the end of the lecture which anybody would like to ask, whether it relates to this particular aspect of the lecture which I'm delivering tonight, or whether it relates to any other matter concerning South Africa. That opportunity to put questions, I will hope, will be given to you tonight. I also want to say before I start that I tried on a previous occasion to express my thanks to the Dalgrau Foundation for having invited me, and I want to repeat that thanks here tonight. I want to express my thanks to the university for the courage and the courtesy which they have shown, and I want to thank, in fact, you here for your presence here tonight and for your tolerance in sitting here despite, in fact, the noise which is being made to make it difficult for you. Change, ladies and gentlemen, is the operative word in the South African political scene, and the forces working for it are many and varied. The black people in South Africa work for change. There are movements outside South Africa, such as the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress. The black states in Africa work for change. The Western powers and the communist bloc all seek change in the subcontinent of Africa. The white opposition wants change in the political, social, and economic system of South Africa, and it can be said that even the government of South Africa is committed to change in certain respects. The issue is, of course, what change is sought by the individual parties and how that change is to be brought about. The cynic says that change is a process in which things remain the same but get better. To the whites in South Africa, change means seeking a society in which they can survive in a predominantly black continent. To blacks, it means abolition of discrimination, and it also means the achievement of political power of which they have so far been deprived. Change for the sake of change is not an object in itself, and it is necessary to assess what each group wishes to achieve. Some wish to substitute black power for white domination. Some wish mere stability, whatever the political system in fact may be. And some wish to extend spheres of political and economic influence. Others wish to further Marxism, and others wish to ensure white survival and prosperity. What do we, who represent the progressive white opposition in South Africa, in fact want? And I believe it can be summarized in two statements. We want to abolish discrimination, not merely abolish it cosmetically, but abolish it in reality. And secondly, we want a constitutional system in which power is shared and minorities are safeguarded. May I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, whether you are able to hear me at all? Fine. The method of change that we believe in is by non-violent means. Violence, we believe, will make reconciliation after change even more difficult. Violence as an instrument is rejected and as a consequence is abhorred. Change for us does not only mean changes in franchise, in constitution and in political participation. The vote has been demonstrated elsewhere in Africa is not an instant solution providing economic and social happiness. Nor does the removal of white control always mean freedom for blacks. It is important that in the process of change, existing institutions of value and means of production are not destroyed. The fabric of society, however critical one may be of its present structures, should be adopted, should be adapted, should be modified where required, but should not be destroyed. Stability without freedom is not acceptable to modern man, but stability is necessary for progress and can be maintained if change is by peaceful processes. There are, of course, those who consider apartheid must fall by force, those who are frustrated and see violence as the only course, and those who have had a vested interest in violence. To the latter, any movement to improve conditions gradually is rejected. Unemployment is desired because it brings revolution nearer. The advocates of peaceful change are described as appeasers, collaborators, cowards, racist and worse, and you've of course heard me described as a fascist during these, in fact, meetings. Some see violence as the only means of achieving personal political power. Others regard violence as an essential ingredient of a class struggle, which in this instance has racial overtones. There are those who believe that greater economic growth is the means of defeating apartheid, and others who argue that greater prosperity means more exploitation. Here the conflict is between prosperity and revolution as the instrument of change. And here I give as an example the fact that when the price of gold went up and there was greater prosperity, it enabled black miners' wages to be quadrupled in 3 years, certainly not, in my view, a sign of further exploitation. Cosmetic changes, ladies and gentlemen, are not enough, but every real change should be welcomed as it erodes the hold that apartheid and discrimination has. Economic progress is incompatible with apartheid, and growth leads to social change. More blacks are educated, more are technically trained, more jobs are created, more skilled jobs must be done, which must be filled then by black people. All of this builds up pressure, which in the end will not allow an apartheid system to survive. I just want to give them a chance to rest their hands a bit. It's been pointed out, ladies and gentlemen, by Professor Rostow in his work Stages of Economic Growth, how social and political inequalities diminished in certain states, including Japan and the United States, as national wealth in fact increased, and demonstrates the same pattern in developing countries. For some years now, a debate has raged on the subject of foreign investment in South Africa. Should it be withdrawn? Should new investments be withheld? In this dispute, the multinational corporation plays a vital part. Multinational corporations are part of the capitalist system, even so though some, for example, in Great Britain, are state-owned and are therefore subject to all the criticism of that system, as well as other criticisms due to their power and their impersonality. Professor Emmanuel Wallenstein of McGill University is reported to have said that he considers the white regimes in Southern Africa, the NATO government and the multinational corporations as belonging to one large political camp. He said this in Disengagement as a tactic in the liberation of Southern Africa. How in fact the South African government wished this were correct, it's actually of course nonsense. Many multinational corporations are active in South Africa. Names such as General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Massey Ferguson, Alcan, IBM, ICI, Unilever, Dunlop, Western, Polaroid, Barclays Bank, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and most major oil companies all operate in South Africa. South Africa's total foreign liabilities total 10,380 million rand, and you'll see the conversion to Canadian dollars on the board at the moment. Of this, direct and indirect investment in shares and stocks at a nominal value represents 1,078 million rand. And share premium, reserves and undistributed profits represents 4,524 million rand. Debentures, loan stock, mortgages and long-term loans to the private sector amount to 1,911 million and short-term loans to the private sector to 13,011 million rand. Another statistic which may be mentioned, namely that in the 12 months ended 30th of June 1976, foreign investors' net disinvestment in shares quoted in the Johannesburg Stock Exchange amounted to 51 million rand. The first question which needs to be answered is what role foreign investment plays in the South African economy. New equity investment in South Africa has tended to play a decreasing role in South Africa. During a relatively difficult period of 5 years in the early 60s, the South African economy had a fair growth rate when in fact there was a negative net figure in respect of foreign investments. Loan and project finance has become more important than equity finance, particularly with massive infrastructure projects underway. Much of the new foreign investment in equity has in fact been reinvestment of profits. In 1974, South Africa had a deficit on current account of the balance of payment of 860 million rand. In 1975, it was 1,616 million rand. In 1976, it'll be worse. As for the 12 months to June 76, it was 1,953 million. The net foreign capital flow for the public and private sectors for the 12 months to the 30th of June 1976 was 1,619 million. Both calendar years 1974 and 1975 having had substantial capital inflows. I hope they're enjoying it. Foreign loan capital to both the public and private sectors continues to play a major role in South Africa's balance of payments. While multinational corporations and the international banking sector do not play a decisive role, they certainly play a meaningful role in the South African economy and cannot be ignored by the policymakers in South Africa. What role do they play in bringing about change? Firstly, there is the direct role. Reports in the English Sunday Times in 1971 and the Guardian exposures of 1973, together with the activities of the SAIC Committee of the House of Commons on pay and conditions of Africans employed by British companies in 1974, certainly caused British companies to take a long, hard look at the activities of their own subsidiaries, of which there are more than 500 in South Africa. There is little doubt that working conditions in many respects improved and that the continued supervision of the British government and its request for publication of employment conditions continues to exercise a healthy influence. Obviously, this has had an effect too on other business and industries, whether locally or overseas controlled, which are not subject to the same degree of supervision. The Polaroid episode, whatever the motives of the instigators, the Polaroid workers' revolutionary movement, whatever they were, it drew attention to the need of United States businessmen to look carefully into employment practices of their representatives and subsidiaries. The Polaroid experiment, as was called in 1971, did result in improved salaries and other benefits for black employees of Polaroid's local distributors, did result in additional training facilities, and made money available for black education. It is perhaps fortunate that Polaroid's South African distributor had men such as Helmut Hirsch, who were themselves dedicated to the cause of black advancement and opposed to apartheid, which made the project a success. What was particularly interesting was about the Polaroid experiment was the view of the Polaroid Management and Workers' Committee and their delegation before the latter visited South Africa. By more than 3-1, they were then in favor of Polaroid's withdrawal from South Africa. But after they had visited South Africa, after they had seen South Africa, after they had spoken to black people, and when they'd returned to the United States, not only the mission, but the committee supported continued involvement. Their recommendation being, do not close the door, but push it further open. Despite the opposition of the Polaroid Workers' Revolutionary Movement, despite attacks at the United Nations Special Committee, the evidence before Congress's Africa Committee, and the accusations of paternalism, The issue was clinched for Polaroid by the clear opinion of South African blacks expressed at that time that the involvement should in fact continue. You see, ladies and gentlemen, these people who make the noise don't speak for South African black people at all. They speak for nobody but themselves. Thereafter, the United States Department of Commerce published guidelines for good behavior by United States firms and recommended the transplantation of United States employment and non-discriminatory practices. Alan Payton, the doyen of South African liberals, in an address at Harvard said, if the American enterprises would improve dramatically the salaries and other benefits of black employees, then I have no doubt this would exert a moral pressure on South African employees to do the same. Therefore, I stand not for the withdrawal of South African investments, but for the dramatic improvement in salaries and benefits. Others, of course, followed suit. Coca-Cola asked black trade unionist Lucien Bobello to assist, and the establishment of a black trade union was recommended. Pepsi-Cola and American Express also acted. IBM had been setting an example with single salary scales, staff all participating in fringe benefits, home improvement loans for blacks, and assisting in acquiring skills, and others followed suit. What all this demonstrated, however, was that the belief that there were legal impediments preventing the improvement of working conditions, that this was not correct. And here I may, if I interpose, and point out to you that in a report which appeared in a local newspaper here only a matter of a day or so ago, the same contention is advanced that there is a bar in South Africa to the improvement of working conditions. This is not correct, and I interpose that to point that out to you at this stage. There are, of course, in many industries, minimum wages in South Africa, but there are no maximum wages. There is job reservation by law, but it affects, except for the mines, a very small number of jobs. There is no law preventing equal pay for equal work. There is nothing now to prevent in-job training. On the contrary, there are tax incentives for it. Nothing prevents assistance for education and housing. And while trade unions for blacks are not recognized in law, they are not illegal, and employers can have workers' organizations with which they negotiate. If you show that trade unions work, then one is on the way to general and then to legal acceptance of this concept. There is little doubt that government policy and laws have often been given as an excuse for unwillingness to act. There is much that can be done within the law and is not being done, so enabling larger profits to be made, with the excuse being given that it's due to apartheid. There are discriminatory laws and practices and conventions. There are some white trade unions which resist black advancement. And the recent dispute between the Chamber of Mines and the White Michaels Union is an example of this. The real dispute in issue was the five-day week, but the demand of the Chamber of Mines that certain advancement in respect of work functions permitted for blacks be given in return. But they are not applicable to everything that can be done, and if an example is set of what can be done within the law, then the pressure to change the law will be irresistible. Material improvement in working condition is not a minor factor. It is not paternalistic. Sound working conditions and proper pay are the very stuff that life is made of. Political change is sought, means not only to prevent discrimination in the personal liberty sense, but also to give equality of opportunity and to make life more meaningful and more fulfilling. There is, however, a word of warning. South Africa is a capitalist economic system, and the face of capital is almost exclusively white. Whatever real encouragement there's been to black business has ironically been given by the government and not by the champions of capitalism. While multinational corporations have given encouragement to improve employment conditions and education, they have done very little, if anything, to create black entrepreneurs or capitalists. Profit sharing worker participation, share acquisition schemes are not on the agenda of the multinational corporations. Growth is a catalyst for change, but only growth in the right sectors, not merely growth which makes the rich richer. Africa is a lesson for the free enterprise system from which multinationals are apparently unwilling to profit from in South Africa. You cannot assume that the black man will always want to be a worker, however much you seek to improve his working conditions. Unless you make the free enterprise system attractive to him and make him part of the capital and entrepreneurial side as well as the worker side, socialism will have irresistible attraction. New wealth which is created by growth needs to be channeled in a manner which will correct old imbalances if a reformed free enterprise system is to be attractive to a deprived people who have found themselves in the economic cul-de-sac of history. If they want capitalism to survive in South Africa, multinationals have a role to play. The role of innovator in a new practices, they can also encourage profit sharing and other means of participation in a reformed free enterprise system for black people. Old-style 19th century capital is not appropriate to Africa of tomorrow. A reformed free enterprise system will be more acceptable. The cry of many black leaders is for socialism, and Western nations on the one hand encourage their political aspirations, but on the other hand hope their investments will be safe if they achieve political power and close their eyes to the reality of the economic demands and plans. The lessons of expropriation and nationalization are ever there for all in Africa to see. To disengage from South Africa is not a practical proposition for multinationals, and one wonders whether this is not actually known by those who propagate it, but who with this knowledge pursue the matter to ensure the foreign investor brings about the changes they demand and they condemn as paternalism. Factories, businesses and assets are not capable of being removed, and even if sold, the proceeds could not of course be remitted. There is relatively little reliance on expatriate personnel. Isolation and self-reliance often improves an economy, as has been demonstrated in wartime, and can result in moral and intellectual isolation and greater determination on an existing course. Exposure to world conditions demonstrates that discrimination cannot survive in the long term and that changes must come. Whatever the merits and demerits of involvement by multinational corporations in South Africa are, and I believe that investment is a force for change, change will and should only come about in reality from the South African people themselves. They will have to determine their own destiny and shape their own future. But in so doing, economic growth and prosperity will make it easier and may allow change without violence, and contact with and exposure to world opinion, whether in sport or culture, in business, industry or tourism, will expose South Africans to opinions and value judgments which will encourage them to build a new South Africa and build it in peace. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes my address. Ladies and gentlemen, I indicated at the beginning that I would be very happy to answer questions, and as it may be difficult for you to be heard when you put your questions, if anybody would like to ask questions, would they mind writing them out, having them given to me here at the table, and I will then endeavor to answer them on the microphone. What I believe is significant for you, ladies and gentlemen, is that you should count the number of people who are preventing the majority from hearing. They are a small minority.
nor do they reflect the opinion of the members of the Vancouver Institute. I believe they represent no one. They do not speak for South Africa. They do not speak for black South Africans. They have a mandate from no one. They are disruptors who seek merely to disrupt for the sake of disruption. If therefore you'd like to ask any questions, please do so.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the tradition of the Vancouver Institute, we would like to give you the opportunity to ask questions of Dr. Schwartz. If anyone wishes to ask a question and would like to try, I would be happy for them to do so. If they would wish. If not, I would suggest that at the end of the meeting, anyone who wishes to ask a question directly to him might come up to the front where we would provide that opportunity. At this point, I would like to call upon Jeffrey Andrew to thank Mr. Schwartz.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have all heard the interference with the opportunity to discuss the problems of one of the vital areas of change in the world today. Mr. Schwartz has put the prospects of peaceful change in a series of three lectures. We are very grateful to him for coming here. The lectures will be printed and widely distributed. Has been given more opportunity than it should have, but it cannot have the final word. Mr. Schwartz, thank you very much indeed. If there are any who want to come down and ask questions, do so.
I thought since we had some new faces in the audience this evening that I would like to invite those who are not members of the Institute to join it on their way out. I would also like to invite you all to next week's Institute's talk, which will be given by Dr. Thomas Hall. On the subject of emerging understanding of cancer causation. Thank you very much. I declare this evening's meeting adjourned. Those of you who wish to speak with Dr. Schwartz should come down to do so.